From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when President Donald Trump cast doubt over the entire purpose of NATO. It was last Tuesday when President Trump joined Fox News' Tucker Carlson and discussed, among other things, his problems with the alliance. Carlson wondered why Americans should be sent to fight for Montenegro. And President Trump stated his agreement with the premise. Why should we fight for Montenegro? What's the sense in going to war for countries we can't find on a map? Well, the answer came from just about every political quarter, led by conservatives who were aghast at the president's dismissal of NATO. Writing for National Review, David French's piece was titled, "Yes, We Should Fight for Montenegro." French writes, quote, "If the last two centuries of American history teach us anything, it's that Allied military strength keeps the peace. Allied military weakness invites war. In other words, if you don't want Americans fighting in foreign lands, you maintain your alliances. America pledges to fight for Montenegro and prepares to fight for Montenegro so it will never have to fight for Montenegro." End quote. NATO officials followed up by reasserting the alliance's collective defense clause. Well, this hour, we'll discuss the value of alliances and whether those alliances have been jeopardized. And I suspect we will discuss the president's performance in Helsinki as well. My guest has decades of experience analyzing just such events in that part of the world. Randy Stone is director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Dr. Stone, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Evan. Good to be with you.
On the subject of NATO, just during the campaign itself, you said, before knowing whom the next president would be of the United States, that your concern was just the rhetoric during the campaign could weaken our alliances with NATO, that it was so negative and so doubt-casting that you were worried about impact there. Well, now, almost 2 years on, we've got a president saying, "I don't get it." So maybe we should first listen to the clip that we're talking about, and we'll get Dr. Stone's response. This is President Trump with Tucker Carlson.
Membership in NATO obligates the members to defend any other member that's attacked. That's so right. Let's say Montenegro, which joined last year, is attacked. Right. Why should my son go to Montenegro to defend it from attack? Why is that?
I understand what you're saying. I've asked the same question. You know, Montenegro is a tiny country with very strong people.
Yeah, I'm not against Montenegro
right.
or Albania.
No, by the way, they're very strong people. They're very aggressive people. They may get aggressive. And congratulations, you're in World War III. Now, I understand that, but that's the way it was set up. Don't forget, I just got here a little more than a year and a half ago.
Right.
But I took over the conversation 3 or 4 days ago, and I said, "You have to pay. You have to pay." And the Secretary General said that because of President Trump, last year we had an additional $44 billion, with a B, billion dollars raised for NATO. And this year it's going to be much more than that. And the countries all agreed. It was very unfair. They weren't paying. So we're not only are we paying for most of it, but they weren't even paying. And we're protecting them. Add that to your little equation on Montenegro.
Okay. Randy, what do you make of that? Let's take the first part first, where he says, "I get it. I get why anybody would say, why would we go fight for Montenegro?"
Well, I mean, the basis of NATO was a multilateral guarantee. Right, that Article 5 of the NATO Treaty obligates every member of NATO to come to the defense of every other member of NATO if they are attacked. It's actually only been invoked once, which was after 9/11. The United States invoked it, and the NATO allies came to our assistance. And they're still in Afghanistan today because we invoked Article 5. The bigger issue here is... How do we want to organize our foreign policy? Do we want to make a series of ad hoc decisions and be relatively unpredictable? We might do better in the short run, right, in various respects, by being unpredictable, by acting like a loose cannon and so forth. But in the long run, what's really powerful is commitment. Right? And our alliance system is based on an intergenerational compact that we've made with Western Europe and has been extended now to most of Eastern Europe that guarantees that the United States will be there. And it doesn't matter who the president of the United States is. Our foreign policy will be based on some long-term principles. And that allows countries to take the risk of sticking with us when that seems like a risky thing to do. So what's remarkable is that as Putin has become very aggressive and has thrown his weight around in Eastern Europe and pushed a lot of boundaries. Our NATO allies have stayed very closely connected to NATO and have worked with the United States because they feel that sort of long-term commitment. Now, I think that Donald Trump is undermining some of that commitment, and his rhetoric during the campaign, I think, was very troubling. It raised the specter that a president could be elected who was not committed to sort of the basics of foreign policy 101, right, of how the U.S. foreign policy works. The fact that he's president now and is continuing to put these things into question is very troublesome.
Just as more as an aside, what is he talking about when he said the people of Montenegro are very aggressive? Do you have any idea?
Well, I suspect what he is referring to is the fear that an alliance partner might take some action which would cause a crisis to spiral out of control and then might draw the other members of the alliance in. I mean, that's what happened in World War One, mm-hmm. right? It's very different now because the balance of capabilities between the United States and its small allies is so skewed, right? That small allies really are not in a position to drag the United States around like Austria was able to drive Germany into war in World War One.
Okay. And when we look at what NATO allies have said in response, they've tried to reassert this idea of collective defense. But, you know, for Americans who don't study NATO and international alliances, I think the president's words may resonate with some people that they're a little war weary. They don't want to be dragged in. And maybe what they would say, Randy, is, okay, well, you got a couple of scenarios you're presenting me. Number one is we are committed to everyone in NATO, yes, including Montenegro, and that means the ultimate defense if needed. Or we could cast doubt on that and not show up when called upon, or we could just withdraw from treaties altogether and say, look, world, you're on your own. We're not the policeman. Montenegro, work it out. We're not coming to some defense thousands of miles away here. And that may be where some Americans are. We're war weary. Can we just deal with ourselves first? And I wonder what you might say to that.
Well, I think it's an example of the long-term costs of the unwise wars that we got involved in Iraq in particular, that it has so stretched our body politic and our population that it causes us to reevaluate fundamental things, right? And those that kind of overextension of U.S. power has all sorts of costs which aren't necessarily calculated at the time. But I think it's worth remembering that NATO brings the United States an awful lot of benefits, and that it's really it's a very good deal for the United States in many respects if we want to be a world power. Now, if we want to withdraw like we did between World War I and World War II and not play an important role in international affairs, well, then, you know, having a large military is a luxury that we could do without, right? And there would be benefits to the United States if we didn't have to maintain a fleet with 12 aircraft carriers and so forth. But if we want to be a world power, then we need allies, right? It's just not possible without them. So NATO approximately doubles American military capabilities in terms of personnel and equipment and so on. Then in addition to that, it acts as a force multiplier. There's some specialization that takes place within NATO. Certain countries are better at doing certain sorts of pieces of operations. And by working together, they're vastly more effective. So any kind of military operation the United States is involved in is much more effective and much less costly because of NATO. Then in addition, having these global bases gives us global reach, right? So it's possible and much less costly to project force around the world if you have these bases and these long-term relationships, right? It also gives us intelligence assets that we didn't have. So, for example, it wasn't U.S. intelligence agencies that first figured out that Russia was interfering in our elections. It was Australian and British intelligence that figured that out, right? Those close relationships are based on trust and alliances. Australia isn't a member of NATO, but it's a U.S. ally. And then we also get diplomatic dividends, right? Because we do things together. And so we tend to make statements together. And when we impose economic sanctions, we do it together. And there's an awful lot of coordination of at the diplomatic level that happens through NATO. And that's very important and often much more effective than throwing threats around. And then finally, you've got credibility, right? So Article 5, this guarantee that we'll come to the aid of any NATO ally who is attacked, draws a line in the sand and renders all sorts of uncertainties clear. All right? So the leading cause of international conflict is lack of clarity of commitments, right? It's uncertainty about the intentions of the other side. And Russia has lots of uncertainty about U.S. intentions in Eastern Europe, right? And they really doubt that the United States is committed to defending far-flung allies, particularly Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which were former Soviet republics that are now members of NATO. Now, the United States has made a commitment to do that. We have not made a similar commitment to Ukraine. Russia has attacked Ukraine. Right? It has not attacked any NATO allies.
No coincidence.
I think that it's very important to have that sort of clarity about what you're committed to, because international conflict usually arises out of bargaining and brinksmanship, where one side isn't quite sure what the other side's bottom line is, right? And they want to test the boundaries. They don't want to go too far, right? Certainty is extremely valuable. The problem is when you start questioning that premise, right, the whole thing may unravel.
Yeah, so right now, does Vladimir Putin have reason to believe that there is enough doubt in NATO's commitment and the United States' commitment that if he wanted to have excursions even into NATO states, that there would be less penalty or no penalty for doing so?
Well, for example, we know that he flew his airplane through Estonian airspace on his way to Helsinki, and he didn't need to do that. It was only there for less than a minute, right? But I'm sure he did that on purpose in order to stick his thumb in Estonia's eye, right? So there's some constant probing going on. Russian airplanes have been flying over NATO airspace and buzzing over NATO ships in the Baltic Sea and so forth and so on. And he ramps that up when he wants to exert pressure, and he ramps that down when he wants relations to get better. So that's been going on. I think it's unlikely that Putin is going to take the risk of invading a NATO ally. For no other reason than that it might re-energize NATO or might change, make American politics less friendly towards Russia and so forth. And that's a risky kind of action that he's unlikely to take. But there are scenarios where there's a conflict that is not going well for Putin, where it seems that it might be useful for him to expand that conflict out of area where he thinks he can exert more pressure. And that's the kind of scenario where it's risky and dangerous. So, for example, if we're playing a game in Ukraine, where on the one hand we're trying to be very cozy, or the current administration is trying to be very cozy with Putin, but on the other hand we're giving substantial military aid, including lethal military aid, to Ukraine. And Ukrainian-Russian relations are very sour, and there's ongoing low-level military conflict there, where Russian forces are fighting against Ukrainian forces. So this is a situation that could become really hot very quickly, either because Russia decides to escalate it or because Ukraine decides to escalate it or something. And if there are a series of miscalculations and the United States and Russia come to a confrontation over Ukraine, Russia might find itself in a position where expanding the conflict to take in the Baltic states looks like it would give it some tactical advantages, right? And if that is not unthinkable, then that could lead us into a direct military confrontation.
Has NATO expanded too far, as some analysts have argued, and clearly the president seems to think in his comments about Montenegro. Has expansion been too aggressive, too far flung?
Well, I was very skeptical about NATO expansion when it was happening.
Why?
I thought that it extended the defense perimeter too far, that it put us on the hook for defending countries that, you know, where the credibility of our commitment to do that might be questioned. And I thought that expanding NATO, particularly into the territory of the former Soviet Union, was a very aggressive move towards Russia at a time when Russia was very weak. And I think in one sense, I was right at the time that it had a very dramatic effect of souring relations between the United States and Russia. Not immediately, right? But it laid the groundwork for the deep antagonism that Russian elites feel towards the United States. And you remember that Estonia is just a short day's drive from Leningrad, St. Petersburg. It was Leningrad when I first went there in 1989. old habits die hard. So it's close enough that it seems very threatening to Russia to have some NATO forces there. That being said, we did decide to expand NATO. We incorporated them into the NATO agreement. We said, you're covered by Article 5. And the commitment to those countries in legal terms is just as strong as the commitment to Germany. So how do we go back from that? It's hard to see how any of NATO continues to survive if we decide not to honor its fundamental commitment. All right, so now we're on the hook. I think now we have to say this is where the line is.
And the argument that I'm hearing from the critics of what the president said last week and again here today are that if we want a world with less war, we must be consistent in our commitment and our willingness to go to the ultimate place if we are called upon. But that commitment actually makes war less likely.
I think it's true that being very clear about what your commitments are makes conflict much less likely.
Okay.
Right? The conflict is usually arises because of lack of clarity about what the bottom line is. I think there is a case to be made that going too far in terms of military preparedness, ramping up your military can be extremely threatening to the other side, right? Can provoke an arms race. I think we're in the midst of seeing this begin to happen with China, right? And so the other error, right, that is often made in U.S. foreign policy is to think that if we're just tough enough and aggressive enough, we will deter all opponents. Right, and that our deterrent posture will never provoke greater efforts by the potential opponent. Right, so I think that the issue in foreign policy is to carefully calibrate what your objectives are, to make it very clear to other countries our objectives go only this far and no further. Right, it's that we're not intending to threaten you. Part of what was threatening about NATO expansion was that it had no clear endpoint. And George W. Bush put on the table expanding NATO membership to Georgia and Ukraine, right, which was completely unacceptable from a Russian perspective, right, for those countries to be incorporated into NATO. That was seen as a dagger pointed at Moscow. So putting that on the table, I think, was extremely unwise. Right, very undiplomatic move, and eventually he backed away from that. The open-ended nature of the commitment was really much more threatening to Russia than the fact that we were making a commitment to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which are very small countries.
And one more question on NATO, and then we're going to turn to Helsinki. And listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we talk about the president's relationship with Vladimir Putin and some of what we saw in the last couple of weeks. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Michael Brendan Doherty also writes for National Review, and he wrote about NATO expansion. He said, quote, NATO expansion changed the nature of the alliance over the last two decades. Dramatically expanding the security guarantees eastward without moving much material has created problems. It's just wild that so many of the troops are still positioned as if Germany and Italy are the first members likely to face danger. Expanding guarantees to Estonia and only having the local militias there seems like we're telling Moscow that our guarantees aren't credible, end quote. What do you think of that?
Yes, well, the decision to keep our forces stationed where they were after the end of the Cold War was made very deliberately in order not to antagonize Russia and in order not to create the situation in Russian minds of facing an escalating security dilemma. Right? So the concern was that if we move forces far to the east, then we're overtly threatening Russia, and that will tend to poison Russia's young democracy. I'm talking about the 1990s, at the time when Yeltsin was in power, and we thought that there was a good chance for Russia to continue to be a democratic country. In addition, of course, we had made some commitments. They weren't legally binding commitments, but George H.W. Bush made the commitment to Mikhail Gorbachev when they met at Malta that NATO would not expand to the east, not a threatening posture, by not moving forces to the east. Right? The forces are staying right where they are. The only thing that was moving was the Article 5 guarantee and the membership and so forth. And they tried to argue that NATO was actually an international institution that facilitated cooperation and so forth and was not simply a military alliance aimed at Russia. Well, things have changed with Vladimir Putin. Russia is no longer a democracy, and Russia is very aggressive towards its allies and is expanding its sphere of influence in the East, and has been making very aggressive moves against NATO allies. So I think the time has come to reevaluate that, and I think that it's correct that there should be permanent forces stationed in the Baltic states now rather than what we currently have is they're almost the same as permanent forces, but they rotate through. So we can say that they're not actually based there. The individual battalions rotate in and out and so forth. I think the political and strategic reasoning behind that posture is out of date.
All right, before I get some phone calls, here's an email from a listener named Dan who says, many people who voted for Trump did so more as a vote against what they didn't want, which was Clinton and the status quo, than for what they did want. Does your panelist see any value in drawing a corollary between Trump versus Clinton and NATO versus Russia? And by that, I mean, does the panelist think that there is NATO allegiance among Americans and Europeans that is based more in aversion to Russia than and their geopolitical aims than it is in robust, sincere support for the actions and ideologies of NATO itself? And he concludes by saying, not to be hyperbolic, but especially since European fear of Soviet communism played an essential role in allowing Hitler to rise up as a strong European hedge against the spread of Soviet communism, I wonder about the consequences of lesser of two evils strategizing. That's from Dan.
That's a really interesting comment. So there are pieces of that comment that I think I definitely agree with. Part of the strategic difficulty that made it very difficult to contain Hitler before World War II was that Europeans and Americans were uncertain whether Hitler or Stalin were the greater threat, right? It also made wartime cooperation with Stalin rather difficult. And he also was unsure which side was the greater threat, whether the Western democracies or Germany was a greater threat to his regime, right? There is, I think it's also true that the creation of NATO was possible because of the unique circumstances that came together after World War II. One circumstance was that the United States was vastly more powerful than the European countries, aside from the Soviet Union, which was a European and Asian power. And so they were dependent upon the United States in a way that they that was historically anomalous, right? Because they had been devastated by the war, needed to be rebuilt, and only the United States had the military capability to serve as some kind of a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was so threatening, right? It was militarily extraordinarily threatening, and it was a very threatening form of social organization, right, which was directly opposed to democratic values and way of life of countries that don't have centrally planned economies, right? So that was a unique set of circumstances and allowed for overcoming age-old controversies among the Allies, right? France and Germany were able to come together. Konrad Adenauer, the first German chancellor after the war, articulated a concept of Westintegration, or integration with the West, which was the touchstone of his foreign policy. The idea was Germany needs to be integrated in Western institutions to protect it against itself and against its own worst demons. So democracy and alliance with the West and integration in what ultimately became the European Union, but was the European Economic Community at the time, that was a strategy that was going to overcome generations of Franco-German hostility and numerous wars that have been fought there and so forth. And this was successful because of this confluence of circumstances. Now, we then had the experience of the Cold War, which over a course of two generations convinced Germans and French people that they could cooperate with each other. Though I remember in the 1980s, there was a lot more uncertainty about whether the legacy of the past in Germany had really been overcome than there is now. All right? So the post-Cold War was also successful. Right? There was another generation in which cooperation was maintained, economic prosperity expanded, and economic cooperation deepened in Europe. Right? So all of this was fostered and supported by U.S. foreign policy, which right from the very beginning tried to encourage the Europeans to work together. Right? The Marshall Plan provided a substantial amount of aid to Europe. But the most important thing that it provided was the impetus for countries to cooperate with each other, because in order to get Marshall Plan aid, you had to form cooperative projects. And so that sort of laid the groundwork for the European Union. So in a sense, European integration is U.S. foreign policy. That was our strategy for trying to make the world a safe place. And it was incredibly successful. Right? So now I see Donald Trump undermining European integration, urging Britain to leave the European Union, right? Criticizing Theresa May for not being sufficiently belligerent in her negotiations over Brexit and so forth. And it's just, again, repudiating the, well, 70-some years now of U.S. foreign policy.
Hmm. Dan, thank you for that email. Interesting. Ed in East Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Ed.
Hello, Doctor. My question involves the Black Sea and the three NATO allies that have coastline on the Black Sea, especially with Putin getting so involved with Syria. Do you think that there is the potential that Putin might be trying to do some sort of a grab against Turkey or the other Black Sea NATO allies, Romania and Bulgaria, in the near future?
That's interesting. So my take on Syria was that Putin's original strategy was to distract attention from the conflict in Ukraine. Because the conflict of Ukraine was a matter of life and death from his perspective for the Russian state, right? And he, I think, sincerely believes that Russia must dominate Ukraine in order to be a world power, and that once Ukraine comes into the U.S. orbit, then Russia will be crippled. I don't think that's true, but I think that's a consistent worldview that I see from most foreign policy elites in Russia. And so I think that Putin shares that. And so creating a conflict or a thorn in the U.S. side in Syria by supporting the regime there, what I think was initially a distraction and an opportunity to create leverage and perhaps bargaining chips that could be bargained away later. But then it's kind of taken on a life of its own. And Russia has gotten deeper and deeper into the Syrian mess. And this is what happens when you invest or try to intervene in one of these intractable conflicts. You get pulled in inexorably. And so Russia is now pretty deeply pulled in, and it's hard to see how they can extricate themselves without the Syrian regime collapsing. Right? It's the same situation that we find ourselves in Afghanistan, for example. They're stuck in the swamp. So now they're trying to figure out how to make Putin's kind of Hail Mary pass to try to create some political leverage into a consistent foreign policy project, which is successful. Right. So you can see the same sort of dynamics that the United States got into in justifying the Vietnam War, right? That the deeper we were into it, the more we had to make sure that it was a success in order to avoid the embarrassment of admitting failure. So I think that's most of what's going on with Russia in Syria right now. It's interesting that, you know, the Syria issue came close to the brink of war between Russia and Turkey. At one point, you'll remember a couple of years ago, a Russian fighter plane was shot down over Turkish territory. And there's just a tiny little knob of Turkish territory that sticks down into a particular place in Syria. The fighter plane went over it and got shot down right away. And this led to a furious exchange of insults between Erdogan, the Turkish leader, and Putin. And Putin described being stabbed in the back. And what had happened was that there had been a meeting on the outskirts of, I think it was a G20 meeting, between Erdogan and Putin, where he thought that they had worked things out and they had an arrangement. And then just a week later, they shot down this Russian plane. And so he thought that he was being betrayed and so forth. And tensions got really tough. But what's happened in the last 6 months is that Russia and Turkey have started working together very closely on Syria and are shutting out the United States. And so in this case, it seems to be because, you know, the United States is committed to its Kurdish allies in Syria, who are the most effective local force that we could use to fight against ISIS, right? So the United States supplied them and so forth and built them up. But Turkey thinks of the Kurds as being a bigger long-term threat than ISIS or any of the other factions involved in Syria. And so they're determined to try to stamp this out. And this gives them an opportunity to ally with the Russians. And so, ironically, the way we've played our hand in Syria has kind of forced our ally, Turkey, into close cooperation with our antagonist, Russia. And Erdogan, in the meantime, has demonstrated that he is very undemocratic as well. So, you know, we're seeing some deterioration of the southern flank of NATO. It doesn't look like, I don't think, it looks at all like Russia might militarily impinge on Turkey or Bulgaria or Romania, but Turkey is becoming a very unreliable ally and may drift into alliance with Russia.
Dan in Brighton next. Go ahead, Dan. Hi, Dan.
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
First thing is you made a grammatical error. You said whom the president shall be, and you should say who. And this is important because you're representing us to the world. We don't want people saying, huh? Those hicks in Rochester can't speak English well. Okay?
All right, Dan, I got to move on. Thank you for the phone call. I promise you, I do 500 hours of live radio a year. There's more than just that in terms of grammatical errors. I ain't perfect, Dan, and when I review the tapes, I'm frequently disappointed in my performance, but extemporaneous speaking is harder than you'd think, and I do my best.
Just one comment on who versus whom. The Russians have a famous phrase, kto kavo, which means who whom. And it's a way of describing the kind of cutthroat internal politics about who's going to get whom.
Get out of here. See, that's a what we took as sort of this weird, banal moment of the show. It took Randy Stone to turn it into something actually interesting. My bad grammar aside. I got to go back and review that sentence, too. Whom receives an action and who creates an action. So I've got to go back. But anyway, Randy Stone is my guest for the hour. He's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. His grammar is perfect. And we have been talking about the president's remarks about NATO, but also I think it's valuable to discuss with Randy his thoughts on not only the president's performance in Helsinki, also what we don't know about what happened in Helsinki. A couple of hours of a private meeting. The president's own cabinet seems in the dark still. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I am concerned about that. First of all, I wonder, well, why does the president want to keep the details of his conversation with Vladimir Putin secret, even from his own security apparatus and from his cabinet? There have been cases before of kind of back channel diplomacy, where, for example, Henry Kissinger would try to negotiate, and he would cut the State Department out of the process and try to negotiate something with the Soviet Union. And the reasoning was, well, this is a way that we might be able to get around some of the diplomatic posturing and reach a solution and so forth. But the concern in this case is that we know that the president has conflict of interest where Russia is concerned, right? And it's pretty clear that Putin has more compromising material to bring out about Donald Trump. We don't know how. It's not clear what could be revealed that would change anyone's mind at this point, because we've learned so much already that's so compromising. But it seems likely that he does. In addition, there's an ongoing investigation into the Russian intervention in the 2016 election, and Donald Trump has a very strong incentive to try to pretend that that didn't happen and that his victory was not secured by Russian intervention in the election, right? That makes him really undermines his legitimacy as president. So he has an incentive to work against that. And then there are all sorts of financial ties between Trump and the Trump Organization and various Russian oligarchs and so forth, which are all constitute a conflict of interest. So it's very worrisome in that context that he will allow Putin and the entire Russian state to know what was discussed privately, but he won't reveal any of that to the United States government.
And so you'd like to be a fly on the wall on that, but should we assume nefarious conversations? Should we assume anything about what we don't know coming out of Helsinki? I mean, it's hard to take most political leaders just at face value anyway. But what's the big concern you have right now, Randy?
Well, I mean, there are some things that may have been transacted there in Helsinki that might be reassuring. So, for example, if by telling Vladimir Putin privately, that we really don't intend to threaten Russia overtly, that could be positive. And it's conceivable that doing that privately is somehow more reassuring to Putin than doing it publicly. I'm not sure why it would be, but it is conceivable that that might be the thinking. The concern really is that in politics, appearances are very, very important, right? And so it's not just the American intelligence agency and diplomats who are cut out of the loop. It's also the American people. We don't know what deals are being struck behind our backs. It's also American allies, right, who don't know whether they're being sold down the river. All right, so if I am the leader of Estonia, I'm very nervous right now because I can't go to the U.S. ambassador and say, well, can you reassure me that Putin didn't get a promise that he can invade my country? Because the U.S. ambassador isn't privy to that information. And ordinarily, information about summit meetings between presidents and foreign leaders is very widely disseminated throughout the U.S. government because that's an important foreign policy event and everyone needs to be on the same page so that they can interpret it properly. Now, another concern is that since only the Russian side knows what was said, the Russian side can say anything they want to about what was said. And we don't have any credible record of what was in fact said. That's very troublesome.
When it comes to the indictments, you have read the indictments of the 12 individuals. Is that right?
That's right. I just was finishing that up this morning.
And there's been a good amount of reporting on this, but I'd love to get your analysis on what you read in those indictments and what you think it means going forward.
Well, they're extraordinarily detailed. I mean, we have never gotten a document like this publicly that reveals anything like so much about methods of espionage and counter-espionage and political manipulation and so forth. So we now understand things like, you know, how it was that they were able to trick us into thinking that they were American people, right, who were making the who were sending the social media messages that they were sending, right? That they had rented space on U.S. servers and they used VPN virtual private network access to get into them, so that when they then made further contacts, they appeared to be coming from the United States. We now know that they engaged in extensive wire fraud, set up false identities or stole American identities, that they created credit cards based on those identities, bank accounts, and so forth in order to engage in illegal election finance. We also know something about the scale of the activities, that they had, at the height of the election, they had 80 full-time social media trolls working in this one organization that we know about. Now, there may have been other organizations that were doing the same thing. Some other reporting has talked about the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, also being involved directly in a lot of these efforts. But this particular indictment focused on one institution, which was called the Agency for Internet Research, which was an operation with several hundred employees, 80 of them full-time working on social media sort of trolling, where they would create false identities and so forth. And it pinpoints a lot of the particular tactics that they use, some of which were really horrifying, like the handle Blacktivist, right, which claimed to be American, African-American, people who were urging other African-Americans not to vote, right? There were also, sort of far-right organizations that they invented. 10GOP claimed to be the handle of the Tennessee Republican Party, and it had many, many more followers than the actual Tennessee Republican Party had. Right. So a lot of this is detailed in the account. And at the height of the campaign, they were spending $1.25 million a month on this operation. Right. So evidently we got access to their budgets. We got access to their internal emails, their strategy memos. It's just incredible how much information the FBI was able to put together about exactly what they were doing and who was doing it.
Do you want to offer any forecasting on what you expect ultimately to come from Mueller yet? Is there enough of a picture emerging in your mind yet on where Mueller is taking this investigation?
Well, I think very good strategy that he went after the Russians first to try to establish facts, right? And I think it will gradually circle back to the Trump campaign and so forth. And I think that there is enough information here that a lot of people who are very close to Donald Trump should be worried about long prison terms. It seems likely, Trump being who he is, that he'll end up using the pardon power to try to protect them and to obstruct the investigation. Now, how that will all play out, I think, depends substantially on the outcomes of the November elections. Because if he is, essentially impeachment proof, then he can stop the investigations pretty easily. But if that's a credible threat, then that becomes difficult for him to do.
I'm going to grab a phone call in just a second. Bill in Rochester, hang there for one moment. But let me just bring up some of the doubt expressed by folks who have observed this, usually from the political right. I had Jim Maxwell, who is a Republican running for Congress in the 25th District, on the program recently. And I'm not asking Randy to kind of weigh in on a political race or politics per se, but what he said regarding Mueller was, yes, he should get the space to do the investigation, but he said, look, we don't have audio of Trump and Putin in a room together or on the phone together colluding about serving each other's interests first over the American people. And absent that, we have a lot of sort of weak tea in Jim's mind there. And we don't have the quote-unquote smoking gun. And I hear that a lot from people saying, well, you don't have direct evidence of collusion. And I wonder what you make of that observation or complaint.
As far as I know, we don't have direct evidence of that implicates Donald Trump directly in collusion. I think we do have direct evidence of collusion by high members of his political campaign, his campaign for office, Paul Manafort and others. So I think this is kind of like the Iran-Contra affair, right? Do you have credible information that directly links the president to a particular decision, or does he have plausible deniability? I think the deniability becomes increasingly implausible. But no, I don't think we have direct evidence that links Donald Trump to this.
Yeah, so best case, he's going to claim all these bad things were happening, but he was totally ignorant of it.
That's a very common defense, right?
Yeah.
Right after, I don't recall.
Okay, let me get Bill in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Bill.
I was wondering if the panelists could address one of the themes that Trump ran on, and one of the reasons I think he was elected, was the idea that he was able to persuade Americans that we have a bad deal with NATO. In other words, Europe doesn't pay their fair share for their defense. I think he's also been successful in selling the idea that the trade agreements we have with Europe and other countries are more in their favor than in our favor. And I was wondering what his thoughts were on that. And I was wondering if you could leave me on the line so I could hear, because I'm not around a radio.
Yeah, indeed. I'm going to put you back on hold. Bill, thank you for the phone call. The question of trade is probably its own hour, and Randy has been here before along with many other guests discussing that. It's a fair one, but let's start with NATO because we're down to 2 minutes. The president has said we got a bad deal in NATO. He's squeezing other countries to pay more. He's claiming some victories there. What do you make of that?
Well, just to be clear, NATO doesn't obligate anyone to make payments, right? He makes it sound like it's a protection racket where they're supposed to pay us. NATO does, or there have been some agreements within the framework of NATO that countries should make certain levels of commitment to their own defense spending, right? And so there was an agreement that was made several years before Trump came into office that NATO members would gradually increase their defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2024. And most of them are making progress along those lines. About half of them have reached that goal. So is this a bad deal for the United States? Well, the United States spends substantially more per as a share of GDP than the average NATO ally does. But I think there's a good question to be asked whether it's really appropriate for rich industrialized countries to be spending as much on the military as we currently do. Right? The United States is the unchallenged military power in the world. We don't need to be spending that much. Getting the Europeans to spend 4% of GDP on the defense is just crazy. That doesn't really serve anyone very well. So that's a question of sort of burden sharing. I would say, you know, one can argue about trade agreements, but the United States is the stronger partner in negotiations over trade. And so, you know, we may not structure those things so that they're to the advantage of American workers. Very often we structure them so that they're to the advantage of American firms. But we usually get what we ask for in those agreements. The other countries usually are very accommodating.
Randy Stone is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. We should come back and talk more trade and economics, shouldn't we?
Look forward to it.
Yeah, and many other things. You're generous with your time. Thanks for coming in again.
Thanks, Evan.
And I should read real quick, against my better judgment, Rob's going to look at me. He's the great engineer here, but I'm going to read it quick, Rob. Monica writes to us and says, Evan, usually I listen and have a strong opinion and want to participate in the conversation. Today, I'm listening and learning a lot. Thank you for being on the air. Monica, that's exactly why we invite guests like Randy. Thanks for listening. Short break, more connections coming up.